Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. This is John Roberts. This morning we are featuring an address given by attorney Diana Boutu to the 2010 Right of Return Conference. It is an important address, rather timeless in character because it deals with a base problem of the Palestinian-Israeli negotiation process, a process that has in its DNA the enduring seeds of failure for the Palestinians, but success for the Israelis. She lays this out beautifully, so we may never be lured into optimism about any future negotiations. I almost decided not to use this presentation because Diana Boutu uses slides to illustrate her points, but she talks us through the PowerPoint presentation in a way that I think does provide translation for a radio audience. Its message is one that particularly Americans need to hear to help us deal with the illusions used by the Western media to sell us on the negotiation process. She also emphasizes the importance of the one ingredient necessary for a just solution to the conflict, an ingredient continually ignored in the so-called peace process, that is, the Palestinians' right to return to their homes and land from which they were driven in 1947-48. Just this past week, Secretary of State John Kerry flew back to Israel to try to steady the latest floundering peace talks by seeking to quell a dispute over the construction of Jewish settlements in East Jerusalem that threatens to poison the negotiations. The Boston Globe reports that Kerry's efforts to steady the talks got off to a bumpy start, with the Palestinians seething over the recent Israeli building announcements, which caused Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to defend Israel's stepping up settlement construction in the face of the negotiations by going on the offense. He had the audacity to say, "I see the Palestinians continuing with incitement, continuing to create artificial crises, continuing to avoid, run away from the historic decisions that are necessary to make genuine peace." Wow, what cojones. As stated many times in this program, negotiations pressed by a dishonest broker, the United States, is a frustrating process that will go nowhere, and most everyone, including the parties, know that. Diana Boutu lays out why. Diana Boutu is a human rights attorney, a former professor at Birzeit University, and former legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team. She currently teaches at Harvard University. Here is Diana Boutu speaking at the Right of Return Conference.
The title of the talk, what I was asked to speak about, was the negotiations process and what's gone on during the peace process, the so-called peace process. And I've given talks on this issue many, many, many times in the past, but this is the first time that I'm actually really nervous about it, really nervous to the point where I was kind of thinking, what do I say? What do I say that they don't already know? What is it that will be new and will change things? And I realized that there is nothing new. And so I'm going to talk about why it is that there's nothing new. I know that for a lot of people with the Obama administration, with the new changing circumstances in the West Bank, that people actually believe that there is something different that is going around, that's going to happen this time around. And what I want to talk about today is how it's really nothing different that's happening this time around, and instead show through a series of slides why it is that nothing different is happening this time around. I ended up adapting my presentation in light of our conversation with Norman Finkelstein yesterday. So forgive me if it's perhaps not as smooth as it should be. And I'm going to try to, as much as possible, leave questions open. So I want to first go through the issue of negotiations and what it was believed that negotiations were going to attain and why that it was believed that negotiations were going to attain this. And it's not so concrete or discrete to look back at the period of 1990 or 1991 or 92 or 93, but it goes all the way back to the 70s. And what I mean by it goes back to the 70s is that after Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip began in 1967, there was a fundamental shift away from the belief that Palestinian refugees should be returning to their homes. This is on the part of the PLO. And instead, there was a shift in belief that rather than focusing on al-Awdi, rather than focusing on the return of refugees, the undoing of 1948, that instead it became an accommodation of current circumstances, an accommodation of Israel's presence, an accommodation to Zionism, with the viewpoint being that rather than focusing on the return of refugees to their homes, that the focus now became on statehood, and with it, all the trappings of statehood. So you get to, you know, hold up a flag, you get to have a little postage stamp, you get to collect the garbage, you get to say that you control your own borders, you get to do whatever, and national anthems, and so on and so forth. And it is this very trap that the PLO and later the Palestinian Authority entered into that has led us down this path, a path that I think that the only way we can get out of is if we redirect and reshape and reframe our mode of thinking. So when the negotiations process started in the 1990s, you know, many people, there's been many, I'm going to step back for a second. After the negotiations process ended in the year 2000, and currently, as we're hearing more and more talk of new negotiations, and in fact, today I'm assuming that we're going to get a rubber stamping on the part of the Arab League to restart what they call proximity talks. And with it, with the restarting of these negotiations, I think it becomes important to step back and ask ourselves, why is it that the negotiations failed? And you'll see a lot of commentary on the question of why it is that the negotiations failed. In my view, the negotiations didn't fail at all. It was quite the opposite. The negotiations very much succeeded. They succeeded in allowing Israel to implement its long-term strategy against the Palestinians. So don't mistake me. The negotiations did not fail from the viewpoint of Israel. They actually succeeded because it ended up being yet another tool that Israel uses in its long-term strategy of trying to confine the Palestinians into as small of a space as possible, take as much of their land as possible, while all the while pretending that there are sort of talks and a partner and negotiations and if only and if only and if only. So really, at the essence, the negotiations process, again, don't misquote me, the negotiations process did not fail from the standpoint of the Israelis. It was a process that was put into place and designed precisely to carry out and implement Israel's long-term strategy. When the process began, Israel had declared that it had wanted a few things out of the so-called peace process. And it was the few things that it ended up getting. The first was that it declared that they wanted to have better international relations with the rest of the world. And you might recall that at the time, Israel was being viewed, and still is, but it was different at that point in time, it was being isolated and ostracized by a number of different countries. With the start of the negotiations process, Israel managed, through Palestinian help, of course, to get an additional 34 countries to sign on to diplomatic relations with Israel. So rather than being ostracized for the fact that it's been carrying out an occupation for all of these years, ostracized for the fact that it's ethnically cleansed 75% of the Palestinian population, instead it ended up being embraced by the international community with 34 countries signing on to it. The second demand that Israel had, which it largely achieved, was that it wanted to have better security. And indeed it did. And during the period of 1993 to the year 2000, 7 years of the negotiations process, Israel actually had the most secure years of its history, with 1999 in particular being the most secure year that Israel ever had. Now, this was not the result of better implementation of security measures, as Israel would claim, on its part, but simply for one reason, which is that it managed to transform the Palestinian people, who are living under Israeli military occupation, it managed to transform them and their leadership into the security subcontractor for the state of Israel. So rather than resisting, which is a right that is enshrined under international law, we ended up being the only population in the history of mankind that was forced to provide security and safety for our very oppressor and occupier. And that is why Israel had the most successful years of it, most secure years of its history. So those were the two things that Israel wanted. It wanted better diplomatic relations, it wanted better security, and it got both of them. But the thing that it ended up getting, which was even more important to Israel, of better diplomatic relations and better security, was the continued land grab. And it's that continued land grab that I'm going to talk a little bit about now. So the first slide that we're looking at, and most of these slides are going to focus on the West Bank and then the Gaza Strip, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the Palestinians, like myself, who are citizens of the state of Israel. This first slide that you're going to see is, you know, it's a very typical slide of the West Bank with all of the cities that are demarcated on it. And here you've got, you know, your very typical Palestinian areas of Palestinian built-up areas sort of showing up on the map, the population and figures and so on and so forth. And here you've got the Israeli settlements that are showing up. Now, you know, yesterday when Norman Finkelstein was talking, he mentioned something that was very important. He said the settlements themselves only comprise about 1% to 2% of the West Bank. He's actually right on that. He's actually factually right on this particular point. But you can see that the way that the settlements were built and have been built and continue to be built, it's not so easy, as Norman Finkelstein said yesterday, to simply just evacuate out 80% of the settlers and put them to 60% of the settlements. And here we've got the Israeli closed areas and military bases. Now, this particular slide I always feel is very important for one reason, which is it doesn't have any of the closures marked on it. It doesn't have any of the checkpoints that are marked on it. It doesn't have any of the roads that are marked on it, anything like that. Nothing on that. But yet, anybody who even has a little bit of a sense of economy and how economies move, just looking at that alone, you can see that the solution that is being pushed forward, that of an economic solution, is one that's simply not going to work. It never will work. It never has worked. Never will work. That even when you have the removal of checkpoints, which is what a lot of the members of the Palestinian Authority are now calling for, even when you do that, even if you simply remove all of the checkpoints, you're still faced with a situation like this, in which the vast majority of the West Bank is no longer in Palestinian hands or in Palestinian control. All right, so here we go to Oslo. And this is what happened during Oslo. So the fundamental thing, I told you, the first thing that Israel wanted was they wanted better diplomatic relations, which they got. The second thing that they wanted is they wanted better security, which they ended up getting. The third thing that Israel wanted, and this is the big prize that Israel wanted, is it wanted to be able to justify its separation of the people from their land. And so the way that they did it is very simple. You classify areas into Palestinian areas and Israeli areas, with Area A and Area B, those two areas that are highlighted there, being the so-called Palestinian areas, where you have a pseudo-Palestinian government coming to pseudo-control the pseudo-area. And then you create the parity, so that just as there's a Israeli government, there's also a Palestinian government. Just as there's an Israeli prime minister, there's a Palestinian prime minister. Just as there is an Israeli president, there's a Palestinian president. Unfortunately, when it comes to Palestinians, we actually have two prime ministers, one president. We had a coup without really having a state. And, you know, the rest is history, so to speak. Anyway, so the point of it was trying to separate Palestinians from their land. And you can see very clearly that this was the beginning basis of how to separate people from their land. You do it ethnically. You try to separate ethnically. Add to that the settlements. Now, the interesting thing about the settlements was that during the period of the Oslo process, a time when, as I said, one of the goals that the Palestinian Authority, or the PLO, had at the time was to create statehood and to focus on statehood and to move away from the issue of the right of return. Instead, compromise rights for something like this. So compromise the issue of the right of return in order to get statehood. And the fascinating thing with all this, and this is the part that is never really clicked for me, is that even during the period of negotiations, even during the period where they were focused exclusively on this concept of statehood and on getting a state, that even during this period, the number of settlements ended up doubling during the period of the year from 1993 to the year 2000. They end up doubling from 200,000 settlers to 400,000 settlers within a 7-year period. It was as though the Oslo Accords gave Israel the green light and just they pushed it and they said, we're going to go ahead and we're going to continue to build and continue to build and continue to build and nobody is going to stop us. And indeed they did. So now what you're looking at is you've got a situation which there are close to 500,000 settlers that are now living in the West Bank. Living in a situation of more than apartheid, in which they control the vast majority of the land. The reason that I wanted to show this slide in particular was in response to something that Norman Finkelstein again said yesterday, which is that his point yesterday in his talk was that he believes that there can be, that we need to start, move away from ideology. And that we need to focus instead on our supporters as being, it doesn't matter what our supporters believe ideologically, but we have to ask them the hard questions. Do you believe in home demolitions? Do you support the construction of settlements? Do you support the confiscation of land? Do you support this? Do you support that? So on and so forth. But one thing, and I, this is a little bit unfair to him because he's not here today, but one thing that I tried to allude to yesterday in our discussion with him was that you're actually focusing on the symptoms when you're focusing on those issues. And you're saying, do we support our this or do you support that? But what he's ignoring is he's ignoring the disease. The disease, the symptom of the, I'm not a doctor, Mustafa is, but the symptom here is the construction of settlements. The symptom here is the demolition of homes. The symptom here is the confiscation of land. The symptom is the confining Palestinians into small spaces. The disease is not that. And it's the disease that we need to start focusing on. The disease is the viewpoint that Israelis have more of a right to live in historic Palestine than the Palestinians do. And in that, in my opinion, is the disease. And that, in my opinion, is the thing that Norman Finkelstein hasn't focused on, which is we have to now start, rather than simply asking the litmus test, do you believe, do you believe, do you believe, do you believe? Instead, we actually have to start challenging the ideology that believes that Israelis have more of a right to live in Palestine than the Palestinians do, that settlers and the colonial movement has more of a right to be there than the indigenous Palestinian population. So with all of that, you then have, after you put on the settlements, you then got a situation, you've then got the closed military areas and the closed military zones. And you can see how during the period of Oslo, and this is current day, these are current day maps, by the way, that the space that Palestinians are living in is shrinking. So the idea is confine the Palestinians into as small a space as possible, take as much land as possible. So again, the tools are home demolitions, land confiscation, so on and so forth. But it's that ideology that hasn't gone away, and it's that ideology that we need to be challenging. Another tool that's used to confiscate land, nature reserves. And this is what we're looking at right now. So the point of all of this is that during the period of Oslo, during the period of the negotiations, that Israel's long-term strategy has been and always will be to try to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible, whether it's by getting rid of them, turning them into refugees, or by confining them into as small of a space and taking up their land. This is the long-term strategy, and this is the strategy that we need to be fighting. Now, here's, you know, I love this slide because it actually shows you what's actually happening, you know, it's when you do something close up. And what you're looking at here is you've got this is actually satellite imagery where the white line there that you see there, that's actually the wall, which you can actually see from above through satellite imagery. What you're looking at first is you're looking at the city of Qalqilia, which is the city that's this round sort of bulbous city to your left. And this is where the wall has gone up. Okay, there's the Palestinian population. Again, the strategy is playing itself out. Confine the Palestinians into as small a space as possible. Take as much land. Two Israeli settlements in the area, combined settler population of maybe 7,000. You've got a Palestinian population of about 50,000 Palestinians. And you can see the fascinating thing is that here, I was part of the team that worked on litigating the case of the wall before the International Court of Justice. And this was one of the slides that we actually ended up using, which is it shows you very clearly the link between what Israel's long-term strategy is and how it is that it's affecting that long-term strategy. So you see in this slide, you've got the two settlements that are outside of the wall, and you've got the Palestinian population, which is actually confined and separated inside that wall. Now, again, this is the part where I often kind of wonder about Israeli statements. You can see that the wall goes around not just the settlement itself, but also around the planned expansion area of that settlement, with the long-term goal, again, being confine the Palestinians into as small a space as possible and take as much land as possible. I think the major issue that I wanted to focus on here, and I'm sorry it's taken me so long to get to it, is that this time around, with negotiations that are about to start in a week's time, and there will be negotiations starting in a week's time, the difference is going to be absolutely zero, with one exception, which is what they actually call the talks. Between the period of 1993 to 2000, they called them negotiations. This time around, they're calling it proximity talks. I don't really know what a proximity talk is. Like, it just means that one person is close to the other and they're not really talking. There's a mediator. I'm not really quite sure what that whole thing means. But the same problem is going to happen that happened during the period of 1993 to the year 2000, which is a problem that I faced during that period, which was that between the period of 1993 to the year 2000, I, for one, and I can't speak about anybody else, but I, for one, checked out. And the reason that I checked out was that I was reading the New York Times, and I was reading the Washington Post, and I was reading the Wall Street Journal. And what was important to me at the time between those years was finishing law school and becoming a lawyer. I don't know why that was so important to me, but it was. And so what mattered to me when I read the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and the New York Times was seeing whether there was a handshake, whether there was a meeting. It didn't really matter to me what was coming out of the meeting, but I felt that things were good. I felt that things were moving in the right direction. This time around, we're going to continue to see the same reporting. It's going to be a little bit different. It's going to continue to be like, did he wink or did he blink? Did he nudge or did he elbow? Did he whatever? Is he sending a message? Is he not sending a message? But that's going to be the only difference, is that in terms of the substance is going to continue to be the same, which is that, first, on the issue of land, Israel has never and will never recognize or acknowledge the Palestinian right to exist in their homeland. It has never happened. It will never happen unless we do something about it, which I'll talk about in a second. The second thing is that, somewhat similar to what Norman Finkelstein said yesterday, is that there's going to continue to be demands on Palestinians to even concede even further on their own territory, something that we've seen in the past and will continue to see in the future. So even if you are somebody who believes in the two-state solution, ideologically believes in the two-state solution, the two-state solution, as they would like to put it, is not going to be one that is based on the 1967 borders or even based on the 1947 partition plan, but instead is going to be based on something that is practical and something that's doable and something that we can this and we can that. With the idea being that as Israel continues to negotiate and puts a gun to the head of the Palestinians, they're going to continue to demand more and more and more concessions from the Palestinians, saying that unless you actually accept and make these huge concessions, we are not going to stop the human rights abuses and the atrocities that we're committing in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, and indeed to the Palestinians who are citizens of Israel and to refugees. That's the next thing. The third thing is Jerusalem. One of the most fascinating things that's happened with Jerusalem is that as the peace process continued and as now the so-called proximity talks are about to launch, half of all of the land confiscation orders that we're now receiving in the West Bank, about half of them are actually in the area of East Jerusalem. More than half of the home demolition orders that are taking place now in the West Bank, in Area C, and in other parts of the West Bank, more than half of them are now coming from the area of Jerusalem, of East Jerusalem. In terms of the issue of building, fewer than 128 permits were issued last year to Palestinians living in East Jerusalem to be able to build their homes. This is a crime. When you hear of a population that is 200,000 strong and growing, to only get 128 permits, housing construction permits, during that year, at the same time when West Jerusalem got more than 8,000 construction permits, it shows you what the long-term strategy is. And do these, and again, the point is really confine and try to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible. Confine them, make life so difficult that they eventually leave. And that policy is not going to change. And finally, and I think the most important thing when it comes to the negotiations, is that there has never been, and there will never be, provided that the current configuration is in place, any recognition that Palestinians have a right to return to their homes, period. This is something on the part of Israel. Unfortunately, that same issue is also taking place within the PLO and within the Palestinian Authority. If you read carefully, and words are very, very careful, if you read very carefully, what you see in every single peace plan, if they want to call it that, every peace plan that has been put forward on the table over the course of the past decade pretty much takes the same shape and form. Oh, you know, some sort of a compromise on territory so that you get somewhat of the 67 borders, somewhat of a compromise so that there's a land swap, somewhat of a compromise when it comes to East Jerusalem. But the fascinating thing, and this is something that the so-called Palestinian leadership and the negotiators are saying, and this is why words are important, is they're not talking about the right of return. Instead, they talk about things called just solutions. Solution does not equal rights. And this is the most important thing that I think we need to be aware of. Now, all of this is to say that when it comes to the issue of negotiations, again, to many of us, the negotiations failed. But we shouldn't be viewing it as a failure of the negotiations, but we should be viewing it as a success of Israel's project in order to try to put forward and promote negotiations. And this is why it becomes very alarming when we ourselves begin to use the language of negotiations and begin to believe in the process of negotiations. The process of negotiations is a process that has been very successful. It's been very, very successful for Israel. Now, with that, I want to talk just for a few seconds about how it is that we move forward and what it is that we collectively can do. My parents. I'm a refugee. My father was displaced in 1948. But what he didn't mention was that not only was my father displaced in 1948, but he didn't just flee to Nazareth in 1948. They actually have quite an interesting story, which will relate to what I want to talk about now, which is that in 1948, my grandmother and grandfather fled, along with, at the time, they had 9 children. They ended up doubling that by 9 years later. So it ended up being a very, very large family that I come from. But in 1948, they fled. And they fled not just from El Mjedel to Nazareth, but they then fled from Nazareth up to Lebanon. And then from Lebanon, they went to Syria. And from Syria, they went to Jordan. And then from Jordan, they became infiltrators, just like there's now this new law of infiltration. It's very interesting how history repeats itself. So they infiltrated back, so-called infiltrated back in 1950. My grandmother recently passed away, and which was very hard and very emotional for me. But just before she passed away, I had a really wonderful opportunity. She died at the age of 97. She was grandmother to, I think it's 73 children, great-grandmother to 198, and great-great-grandmother to 13. So she was a remarkable, remarkable woman. But one of the things that she ended up saying to me before she passed away, she was a very feisty woman, was I asked her, I said, you know, Grandma, why did you flee in 1948? And these are the stories I think are very important because we never have this conversation as families. We never really talk to one another about what's happened in history and why and what they were thinking, what her dreams were and what have you and so on. And I had the opportunity, I asked her, so why did you flee in 1948? And she said, we didn't flee. I was like, well, what do you mean you didn't flee? She said, we were waiting for the Iraqi army. Jesh al-Fawzi. Waiting for the Iraqi army. Now, anybody who's read history, they know that they sort of stopped at the West Bank just in order to protect their little protectorate and what have you. But this was the what she was told, is that they were not fleeing, they were just going to be leaving because they were waiting for the Iraqi army. And they waited for the Iraqi army for a period of about 2 years. It gets better, the story gets better. So they waited for the Iraqi army for a period of about 2 years. And in 1950, when she decided, and she was the one who decided, it wasn't my grandfather, it was her, she was the one who decided. 1950, she decided that she was going to go back, and she was going to go back to Palestine. They didn't know that El Mjedel had been taken over at this point in time. When she decided to go back, I asked her, I said, well, why did you decide to go back? And she said a very important thing, which has stayed with me forever, which is, I realized that the Iraqi army was not coming. Okay. And so this is the point, is that we have been waiting for far too long for the Iraqi army to show up. We've been waiting. We put our faith in a leadership that has proven that it cannot lead. We've put our faith in a leadership that has proven that it is corrupt and that it's more interested in maintaining the trappings of power and continuing to implement Israeli strategy. We've put our faith in the U.S. administration, believing that somehow, if only Americans knew a little bit more about us, that they will somehow change and that the U.S. administration will change and that U.S. policy will change. We've been waiting for the Iraqi army for far too long. And it's time for us to now no longer wait for the Iraqi army. And it's time for us to actually start doing things just in the same way that my grandmother in 1950 decided, despite everything, with at that point in time now 11 children, no longer 9, to go back to Palestine. She was no longer going to wait for the Iraqi army. And this is what it's now our duty to do this as well. We cannot wait for the Iraqi army any longer. We have to take matters into our own hands. So the question becomes, what is it that we do? There's a few things that I think that we need to focus on. First is we need to focus on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. We need to focus on this. Yes, thank you. We need to focus on BDS for, and you know, I don't want people to say, oh, it's not going to do anything, it won't work, it won't this, it doesn't. It will work. It will work. It will work. And even if it doesn't work, at least we tried. And it will work. It will work. Now, the reason we need to focus on boycott, divestment, sanctions, and I know I'm speaking to an audience of people who are sympathetic, is that for far too long, Israel's just gotten away with matters. They've gotten away with murder. Literally, they've gotten away with murder. And the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is the only thing that is going to try to put a stop to Israel in terms of not being able to get away with murder any longer. The second thing, and I think this is also a very important thing, is we need to start focusing on our ability, Palestinian ability, to stay in Palestine. If you believe that the long-term strategy of Israel is to try to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible and take as much land of theirs as possible, then the only response that you can have to that is to make sure that Palestinians actually remain in their land. That's it. So what I mean by that is there are a lot of projects that focus on Sumud. These are the projects that we need to start focusing on now. These are the projects where we need to start. Palestinians don't need more ambulances. Really, they don't. What we need is we need strategies that ensure that Palestinians actually remain on their land, on the ground. That's the second thing. And with that, I think that it becomes crucially important that we stop focusing on the divisions that are taking place within our own community. And there are plenty of divisions that are within our own community. I don't care about Hamas. I don't care about Fatah. I don't care about all of the petty politics. To me, it goes back to something that Mustafa actually once said, which is all of this is a group of bald men fighting over a comb. Really. And that's what it is. So it doesn't matter to me who's in charge or why they're in charge, but what matters to me is whether any of these organizations have as their primary goal making sure that Palestinians remain on their land. And the third, and I think one of the next strategy that I think we need to start employing is that something that Jess referred to, Jess spoke about yesterday, which is holding people accountable and trying to make sure that Israeli leaders get held accountable. One of the most fascinating things that has happened as a result of the Gaza massacre is that Israelis can no longer travel. They are afraid to travel. The Israeli leaders are afraid to go to the UK. They're afraid to go to other countries within Europe. And it's a growing movement now that I want to continue to see, which is I want to make sure that it's not just Israeli leaders that are held to account, but that it is the Israeli people that are now held to account. I don't like this fiction of separating the people from the leadership, because I personally believe that the only way that people will be held accountable is if the actual people are now beginning to be held accountable for the actions of the government. That's one of the next things. In addition to that, I also believe that there's a lot of legal strategies that we can be employing on this matter. I'm not a lawyer who believes that law is just sort of developed out of a vacuum. I really understand the power dynamics that go into development of law. But I think that as a whole, we're a growing community. We're getting stronger. We're getting louder. 10 years ago, there weren't this many people in the room. In two more years' time, this room will be double the size it is. It will be double the size that it is. And so because of that, our voices are becoming louder, they're becoming stronger, and we need to start focusing on other mechanisms to ensure loud. The final thing that I think is one of the most important strategies that we need to focus on is that if you look at one of the elements that has divided us as a community, and I'm not talking about factionally, but I'm talking about as a community, has been this debate of two-state, one-state, Hamas, Fatah, so on and so forth. I think that we're wrongly placed, we are misplaced at focusing on that as being the primary dividing point. That is not, to me, the primary dividing point. The primary issue for me is, do you believe that Palestinians have the right to return? That's it. Do you believe that Palestinians have the right to live in their homeland? That's it. It doesn't matter to me, and it's never been a question. I've never been a person who's believed that statehood or the concept of statehood, whether it's two states or one, will be something that actually enshrines people's human rights. It never has in the history of mankind. It never will in the history of mankind. States are actually oppressors of human rights. They are not elements that uphold human rights. Instead, we need to start focusing on the concept of al-awda. And if we focus on the concept of al-awda as a community, I think that we will be able to overcome this long-term strategy that Israel has, whether it's a strategy that Israel has, whether it's a strategy that the Palestinian Authority has bought into, or whether it's a strategy that has been used to divide us as a community. We need to start focusing on our unity, and our unity is al-Awda. So with that, I want to thank you very much, and I'm open for questions. Thank you.
That was Diana Bhutu speaking on the flawed negotiation process to the Right of Return Conference in 2010. And now, with the few minutes we have left, I would like to focus on the news stories this week concerning the scientific tests conducted on the remains of Yasser Arafat to determine the cause of his death in 2004. Al Jazeera reports that Swiss scientists who conducted tests on samples taken from Yasser Arafat's body have found at least 18 times the normal levels of radioactive polonium in his remains. The scientists said that they were confident up to an 83% level that the late Palestinian leader was poisoned with it, which they said moderately supports polonium as the cause of his death. A 108-page report by the University Center of Legal Medicine in Lausanne, which was obtained exclusively by Al Jazeera, found unnaturally high levels of polonium in Arafat's ribs and pelvis and in soil stained with his decaying organs. The Swiss scientists, along with French and Russian teams, obtained the samples last November after his body was exhumed from a mausoleum in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Dave Barclay, a renowned UK forensic scientist and retired detective, told Al Jazeera that with these results he was wholly convinced that Arafat was murdered. Yasser Arafat died of polonium poisoning, he said. We found the smoking gun that caused his death, and we don't know who is holding the gun at the time. The level of polonium in Yasser Arafat's rib is either 18 or 36 times the average, depending on the literature, he said. Suha Arafat, the late Palestinian leader's widow, received a copy of the report in Paris on Tuesday when they came with the results. I'm mourning Yasser again, she said. It's like you just told me he died. The Swiss report only examined the question of what killed Arafat. It did not address the question of whether he was deliberately poisoned or how. By October of 2004, towards the end of the Second Intifada, Arafat had been holed up for more than 2 years in Ramallah, which Israeli troops had surrounded, where Israeli troops had surrounded his compound. He was elderly and frail, but his medical reports show he was in good overall health and did not have any particular risk factors, the Swiss report states. On the evening of October 12th, Arafat suddenly fell ill after eating a meal. Based on his symptoms, nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain, his personal doctor initially diagnosed flu. But Arafat's health deteriorated swiftly, and Egyptian and Tunisian doctors flown in to see him could not pinpoint the source of his sickness. On October 29th, a wan and weak Arafat was carried in a wheelchair from his headquarters. He waved and blew kisses to the crowd outside and flew to Jordan by helicopter. From there, a French government plane carried him to Paris for emergency treatment at Percy Military Hospital. French doctors were unable to diagnose or halt Arafat's decline, and he soon lapsed into a coma. On November 11th, Arafat, who symbolized the fight for Palestinian statehood, died at the age of 75. Doctors at Percy Hospital did not conduct an autopsy, announce the cause of death, or release his medical records, which heightened speculation about the cause of his rapid demise. Many Palestinian officials close to Arafat believed he had been poisoned. In the West, rumors circulated that he had died of AIDS. Some doctors suggested leukemia or a foodborne illness that killed Arafat. Others proposed that he had simply succumbed to old age. By 2011, when Al Jazeera began an investigation, Arafat's death was a cold case. During the investigation, Suha Arafat gave the network access to her late husband's full medical records and a bag of his belongings, including clothing he had worn during his final days. Tests conducted by the Swiss scientists who issued the new report found elevated levels of polonium-210, one of the elements of isotopes, in blood, sweat, and urine stains on Arafat's clothes. In July 2012, Al Jazeera broadcast the results of its investigation in What Killed Arafat. The documentary triggered a French murder investigation and led to the exhumation of Arafat's remains. 60 samples of his body tissue were taken and 20 each distributed to the Swiss team, a French team of judges and forensic experts assigned to the murder investigation, then a Russian group invited at the request of the Palestinian Authority. The Russians are expected to disclose their results soon. The French are not expected to release their results before the murder investigation concludes. Suha Arafat's lawyer and the Swiss report was a significant piece of the jigsaw puzzle. That could help the French murder inquiry. Polonium is a soft, silvery-gray metal found in uranium ore. The isotope polonium-212 emits highly radioactive alpha particles, but they do not travel more than a few centimeters in air or are stopped by a sheet of paper or by dead layer of outer skin on our bodies, says the International Atomic Energy Agency. For that reason, polonium-212 is not a risk to health as long as it remains outside the body. But a dose of 1/10 of a microgram, the size of a speck of dust weighing less than a millionth of a snowflake, would be fatal if it were ingested in food or liquids or inhaled in contaminated air. Only a handful of people are reported to have died from polonium poisoning. The most famous case involves Alexander Litvinenko, a former KGB officer turned dissident who received political asylum from the British government and lived in London. Litvinenko died in November 2006, 3 weeks after meeting several Russians, including a one-time KGB officer, at London's Millennium Hotel. A British public prosecutor alleges that the Russians were acting at the behest of their government and poisoned Litvinenko by lacing his tea with polonium-210. Polonium-210 is one of the most obscure, most bizarre, and yet most merciless of poisons, writes Alan Cole, in The Terminal Spy, a book about the Litvinenko case. It was used as a trigger for early nuclear weapons and subsequently as a power source for satellites and spacecraft. However, polonium-210 is extremely rare and would be difficult to obtain without the help of a government or access to a nuclear reactor. It also requires considerable scientific know-how to handle in a safe manner. Polonium-210 is manufactured by bombarding bismuth-209 with neutrons in a nuclear reactor. Only about 100 grams are produced each year, almost all in Russia. In terms of motive, the chief suspects would be Arafat's Palestinian rivals or the Israeli government, his sworn enemy. Ariel Sharon, the prime minister in 2004, viewed Arafat as a terrorist and called his death a turning point in Middle Eastern history. A year earlier, then-Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said killing Arafat is definitely one of the options. However, Israel has always vehemently denied it, that it had anything to do with Arafat's sickness or death, and to date no evidence has emerged that implicates it. While Barclay expressed confidence in the cause of death, he said it would be a difficult case to solve. "The main problem is the time frame," he said. "If this was a murder that happened yesterday, you'd have witnesses and cell phone records, emails, bank transfers. In the 9-year-old case, that type of information will be hard to obtain." "We can't point a finger at anyone," Suha Arafat said. "The French are conducting a serious investigation. It takes time." Well, that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine. Please join us every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. for news, analysis, and commentary from Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.